I'm Dr. Noah Emery.
I'm Sam Acuff.
And this is the Addiction Psychologist Podcast.
On today's episode, we're going to talk to Dr. Kate McHugh. Kate is the director of the Stress, Anxiety, and Substance Use Laboratory and the director of the Behavioral Therapy Development, Training, and Research at McLean Hospital. She's also an associate professor of psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Kate's going to talk with us about cognitive behavioral therapy for substance use disorders.
Kate, welcome to the show.
Thank you. So happy to be here. Thanks for the invite.
And we're really happy to have you.
As I said before, I'm a big fan. I've been listening to the podcast, so thanks for what you guys are doing. This is great. Happy to be a part of it.
Yeah, we appreciate it.
It's very kind of you. So we like to start off our episodes by talking a little bit about our guest's training history. So if you wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about your background.
Sure. So I'm a clinical psychologist by training. Did my graduate work at Boston University with primarily with Michael Otto, also a little bit with Dave Barlow. So my training was actually mostly in anxiety disorders. So I'm sort of a dyed-in-the-wool CBT-er from an exposure therapy perspective. And while I was there, we also did some work with opioid use disorder, particularly applying CBT to folks with opioid use disorder who were also in methadone maintenance. Mm. So did my graduate work there, went from there down to Brown for internship, which was a great year. Loved my time down there, worked some at Butler Hospital and some at the Providence VA, which was just great, really tremendous clinical training experience down there. And after Brown, came to McLean Hospital, which is actually where I'd done my research assistantship post-undergrad, and have been working here actually for almost a decade now, doing research in the area of substance use disorders and co-occurring disorders, and also some clinical work as well.
You've spent a lot of your time in hospital setting, actually.
Yeah, almost all of it. As in graduate school, it was an outpatient clinic. The Center for Anxiety was where we did most of our clinical. But I've done the VA rounds at the Boston VA, Mass General Hospital. So I love being in a hospital setting. I love the interdisciplinary nature of it.
Yeah, sounds a little more fast paced than an academic setting.
It's very different in some ways. I have to say the thing that I miss is the big conference room where people are always in and out and they're eating lunch and everybody's sort of hashing out ideas. I miss that about the arts and sciences setting. Mm. But otherwise, yeah, the fast pace is fun. It's fun to be, walking around and clinical units and people from all kinds of disciplines. It's keeps you thinking.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And to be more applied, I think a lot of people in academic settings are just a little bit more removed from clients. And so I think being there probably in many ways gives you this edge that others might not have by talking to people more often. So, yeah. Well, we're very excited about this and thank you so much for agreeing to come on and as the listeners might know, this is the second episode in a series that we're doing on intervention and treatment for substance use disorders. And so last month we had Jim Murphy come on and talk about brief motivational interventions. And now we're going to have you talk about cognitive behavioral therapy for substance use disorders. So, at least in my mind, kind of moving up a notch in sort of the severity spectrum. So could you give us a little bit of an overview of CBT, sort of the nuts and bolts?
Sure. So CBT is something that, certainly is applied to pretty much any psychiatric disorder and has efficacy for pretty much any psychiatric disorder. Even some of the disorders that we think of as really steeped in medicine, even the psychotic disorders to some extent. Mm. So for substance use disorders, effectively what you're looking at is how do we leverage behavioral processes, cognitive processes to engage in desired behavior change. Mm. So like you mentioned, we're sort of one step in terms of severity level up from your prior episode is in many cases, these are folks who have a desire for a behavior change already. And what we're looking to do is, how do we support people around that? How do we build skills or leverage behavior change in a way to get people where they want to be?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So could you talk to us a little bit about those mechanisms of behavior change?
Sure. So in CBT for substance use disorders, a lot of it is skills focused. So for other disorders, sometimes you might be targeting different mechanisms. You know, fear extinction, for example, in an anxiety disorder. For substance use disorders, oftentimes we are targeting potential skills deficits. And whether those be deficits because a substance-related behavior has been sort of overlearned over time and over-relied on, so maybe we're replacing that with something new. It could be a skills deficit because if we actually think of the risk period for a substance use disorder in terms of disorder onset, oftentimes the onset of at least substance use is occurring at the same time that a lot of other developmental milestones occur. So if substance use is initiated, particularly if you think of something like adolescence, some of those developmental milestones get either missed or sort of papered over by the substance use. So the one example I always think of with this is with cannabis. So if you have someone who 13, 14 years old is starting to use cannabis heavily, they are learning all of those skills that happen in adolescence in the context of cannabis. So social skills, coping skills, all of this is happening within that context. So sometimes we're going in, we're actually looking to redevelop those skills outside of the context of the substance. Sometimes the skill is coming in to replace what the substance is doing.
Yeah. So in that case, it's kind of like, you know, someone learning how to engage socially by using cannabis. And so part of the CBT in that scenario would be to then teach skills, just communication skills and social engagement skills outside of cannabis use.
There's a really salient example that comes to mind from young man who I had worked with, adolescent, who was looking to, it was actually cannabis use in this case, was looking to discontinue his cannabis use because it had a number of consequences, academic consequences, athletic consequences, he was a high school student. And I remember sitting across from him and he said, "I have no idea how to function if I'm not smoking weed. I am a stoner. It's my identity. I don't know how I would interact with my friends. I don't know how I would, you know, function in the classroom or on the soccer field or any of these things if I didn't have that." So that's always the example that comes to mind from where you can see that skills deficit set in.
Yeah, I think that's such an interesting part about, you know, substance use disorder, right? Is that it kind of onset and development kind of co-occur with the onset and development of kind of independent living and a bunch of, you know, just mechanisms that exist in humans that allow us to navigate our world effectively and to make sense out of our sensory experience and such. Right. And, you know, the traditional, you know, cognitive behavioral approach kind of is anchored in the idea of the cognitive model, right. Which is basically that all of us have these kind of inner working parts that have interrelationships with each other, which are your cognitions, your thoughts, right, your feelings or emotions, and your behavior, right? And that, like, how I feel affects what I think and what I do, and what I do affects what I think and what I feel, right? And, you know, that given rise to a whole therapy approach where we kind of investigate a little bit about how people are making meaning out of their experience, you know, and looking at what they're thinking and how that's affecting their feelings and their behaviors and so forth. And, you know, kind of steeped in the idea of, like, you know, depression or anxiety have, like, very specific set of cognitions and feelings that push around behavior and so forth. And a lot of times when I talk with other clinicians, they, like, know all that stuff I just said. But when I'm like, apply CBT to this substance use disorder, they're like, "Whoa, hold up. I don't understand how that works." And I was wondering if you could maybe walk us through a little bit about how those constituent parts kind of come to life in a person who's, you know, struggling with a substance use disorder, and, you know, how that then kind of, you know, facilitates behavior changes you kind of describe with these skills and so forth acquisition.
I think your reference to that three component model is probably a good framework for us to jump off of. So the, you know, thoughts, feelings, behaviors. And, you know, oftentimes when I'm presenting a CBT model to somebody new, I sort of use that as the jumping off point. And in part because it shows we have these three interlocking pieces, and we can intervene at any one of the three. Mm-hmm. And I think giving that message to people is really important, because these are tremendously difficult changes that people are trying to make. And there are lots of challenges where sometimes you make a change and the benefit actually takes a while to set in, which is very difficult behaviorally. But if we think of these three pieces, cognitively, if we start there, much of the focus there is identifying patterns of thinking that may be maladaptive. So patterns of thinking that are either causing distress or dysfunction, or might be pointing people in a bad direction. You know, our cognition functions in terms of heuristics or shortcuts. It has to. We could not process everything that was coming at us otherwise. And sometimes those shortcuts are tremendously useful. Making judgments about things very quickly, assessing situations very quickly, but sometimes they can become problematic. So a good example of a heuristic that can go wrong is black and white thinking, which means we have to sort of force things into good or bad. And when we force things into good or bad, oftentimes we can make extreme decisions. So things are good, things are bad. And in one place where you can see this is, you know, I am an addict. You know, oftentimes it's a stigmatizing term. I'm an addict or I'm not. And if I'm just an addict and I'm always going to be an addict, why do anything differently? I'm not capable of change. So sometimes we're identifying what some of those thinking traps might be. Black and white thinking is a common one. Catastrophizing is another one, which is, you know, assuming the worst case scenario. And you know, it's interesting when you hear people describe this. A lot of people will use terms like spiraling or sort of rabbit hole thinking, where, you know, the thought goes from this bad thing has happened, you know, my boss says he wants to meet with me later, so I assume I'm in trouble. Yeah. And I assume I'm in so much trouble that I'm going to get fired. And when I get fired, I'm going to lose my housing. And when I lose my housing, you know, and it sort of ends at I'm, you know, going to be homeless and unable to support myself. And again, if your thinking is going down that path, not only is there a process of suffering, but that can motivate something that might achieve relief.
Right. Yeah, because that's the thing about substances, right, is they are highly rewarding in the immediate. So when people feel bad, you know, they're going to be more likely to use a substance. And you give this example of sort of like a thoughts spiraling out of control and that leading to behavior. So these all work in the other direction though as well, right?
Absolutely. And so, you know, there are a number of things that we can do behaviorally. And one of the real foundational skills of CBT is functional analysis, which is looking at what is the function of a behavior. So when you're doing a functional analysis, you're looking at what is the context. So what's the context? What might be sort of triggering or motivating this behavior in the context? What is the actual behavior? And what are the short and long-term consequences? Because we, in some ways, we're simple creatures. You know, we behave for the most part for one of two reasons: to feel more good or less bad. There are habits in the mix too, but for the most part, we are relatively straightforward in that one. So that is another big piece of CBT, is understanding what is the function of substance use. What is it affording somebody? Is it social connection? Is it relief of stress? Is it, I'm bored and I want to feel something different? And in understanding the function of that behavior, that then gives us a jumping off point for how do we intervene behaviorally? How do we replace that behavior? How do we change the context to reduce the likelihood that it's triggered? That's another big piece of it.
I think that's critical because, you know, it's so tempting based on societal expectations of people who use substances and of addiction and stuff like that, that, you know, there's the moral models embedded in every conversation about substances, and understanding that, you know, behavior is sort of in part an outcome of the environmental contingencies that, you know, lead you to say like, well, I did this for a reason. Even if maybe in the future, it's going to end up being bad for you. Maybe even tomorrow, it's going to be bad for you, you know, but there was a good reason that you did it. That doesn't make you a bad person. It means that, you know, you made a decision based on the information you had at the time that led you to that decision.
And that's so important because there's a tremendous amount of shame in these disorders. And why can't I just, why can't I just stop? Why can't I just change? Why am I doing this if it's ruining my life? And, you know, to your point is at some point it probably was working in the context that the person was in.
Right.
Maybe it's not working anymore, but at some point people do things for a reason.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's why I think the functional analysis component is such an elegant tool. Shout out Partial Hospital Butler, where I did my internship residency at Brown too. And shout out Butler Hospital. That's where I really learned how to do the functional analysis component. Right. And it's like, it's such an elegant tool to understand, like to teach people why they do what they do, but also to teach family members why things are happening the way that they are, and to kind of get away from this idea that like, why can't I just stop? And it's like, well, it's doing something, right? Like it's still doing something, even if it's not as big as it once was, or is offset by now negative consequences or whatever, right? But just understanding, right? Like you have this contextual component, right? This trigger point in that gave rise to thoughts and feelings, and ultimately this behavior that you're trying to change, but that change, that behavior has a function. It gives rise to positive consequences. Drug use has positive consequences. Like it made me feel better, right? It made helped me avoid, but it also has these like more, you know, negative consequences that are like more, you know, delayed and all these kinds of things. And the understanding that, you know, the drug use is reinforced because it has immediate, certain, right, positive consequences that like, I know for sure, if I get high right now, I'm going to feel this right away. Right. Whereas if I do an alternative behavior that is, you know, like, you know, exercising or some, you know, distress tolerance technique or something, that has a delayed reward, right, that isn't immediate or certain necessarily. And all the negative consequences a lot of times with substance use are, you know, variable. Not everybody experiences homelessness or, you know, arrests or
hangover
or even hangover. Yeah. Right. Yeah. You know, and that, so they're variable and they're also often delayed, right? Like you don't use in the immediate sense, like instantly arrested, right? Like that doesn't happen. Sometimes it happens, but it's, you know, variable. Yeah. Right. And so it's easy for us to get this negotiation, if it's even conscious, this negotiation that like, that makes more sense than this. Right. And so people just kind of fall into this kind of well-worn groove, right, that this has this operation for them. And it becomes really challenging to kind of get out of that trench, right, because it has been so functional for them for so long. And then with it comes all these additional components, like, you know, adaptations to the brain and, you know, kind of whittling down of their environmental contingencies that offset use, like other people who are incompatible with it or other activities that are incompatible with it. And so I think that that's such an important component. I'm really glad you brought it up, because I think that just helps lays the groundwork for how we think about substance use, getting away from this moralistic model of like, why don't you just stop? Right. Which is like a lot of times what I hear from families when they're talking to the clients that I work with.
And it's so important. And I even talk to this a lot with people who are training and catch myself doing this is, as clinicians, we are also vulnerable to empathy failures. Mm-hmm. Is a, you know, what clinician out there has never had the thought, why don't you just stop in that moment? And I think that anchoring ourselves in that model and understanding that, you know, we are built to respond. The more proximal the reinforcement, the more the behavior gets reinforced.
Right. Yes.
This is why you mentioned exercise. You know, if someone's looking to initiate exercise, the worst reason to initiate exercise is for long-term health. Because if I run at the end of the day today or don't, that will have no measurable effect on my cardiac health in 30 years, just from today. If I work out today for the mood benefit or for a social benefit, mm-hmm. or for, you know, again, that endorphin benefit that you get immediately, you're much more likely to engage in the behavior. So it's, you know, it's not a process that's unique to substance use disorders. We, you know, the sooner the reinforcement is, the more likely you are to repeat the behavior.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a great point. And And when I do a functional analysis with people, right, like it's designed to look at all the different places that we can interrupt, right? Like a lot of times I can't change your situation. I can't change that you ran into so-and-so at the grocery store and they were like, I haven't seen you in forever. Let's have a party, right? Like I can't necessarily, like maybe we go to a different grocery store, but that's happened, right? And then, you know, there are a bunch of thoughts that come along with that. A lot of times the thoughts that I think that are unique to substance use, as opposed to if you were dealing with depression or anxiety, are these permissive thoughts. They're like, you know, it'll be different this time, or I can, you know, and challenging these more permissive related thoughts. Right. And then there's all these feelings that go along with it, but then there's the behavior change that we can have there. We can, you know, supplant that with an alternative behavior. The key is to anchor it in those consequences, positive and negative, short and long-term, such that, you know, think about it, right? Like you go to exercise. Very few people I know have been arrested because they exercised instead of, you know, use cannabis, right? Like I'm sure there's something somewhere out there that happened, but it's just really unlikely.
Sure.
Right. You know, and then you just got to like kind of help a person understand how this alternative behavior would function for them in a meaningful way, and then allow them to kind of ingrain that a bit. I think is such a very elegant and straightforward process that can produce, I think, really meaningful change.
Replace, don't remove.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a mantra we use all, you know, don't, you know, sit on your hands at that time that you would normally drink or out at a, you know, plug something else in there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it makes me think a lot about, like, I always think of like the environment as almost the topography of like a valley or a mountain, and, you know, behavior is rain that falls down and sort of goes in, and it's going to happen. You know, the river is going to form the way it forms because the environment is structured in a way that leads the behavior to that. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the really hard parts about any treatment for substance use disorder is that the substance use has become reinforced based on the contingencies in the environment. Like, you know, there are very few alternatives. There may be no real rational reason that someone should be thinking long-term because they, you know, there might not be a lot of hope to get to the long-term. You know, a lot of their friends are using, and if they don't hang out with those people, they're criticized by their family because they, you know, use drugs. And so how do you address that? How can you actually use CBT to help someone start to restructure their environment to give them the reinforcement that they need?
One of the real challenges, and I think that's such a great metaphor to think about, is one of the real challenges there is that topography takes a long time to change.
Right.
That's not a, you know, I don't drink for 2 weeks, you know, and that valley has filled in.
Right.
And I think that's a real frustration for people. And that's something that I'm oftentimes very frank with people about, is that you're going to work your tail off to make some of these changes, and the environment's going to take time. Trust in the social network is actually a really good example of this, that you can work as hard as you've ever worked and really work to regain that trust. And it's not going to come back tomorrow. It's not going to be there the day that you leave residential treatment, for example. So same thing with things like employment. Like you said, sort of, you know, lack of hope towards the future, lack of opportunities. Those things take time to change. And to some extent, there are things that you can do to support people, but one of the most important things you can do is support people around what their expectations should be.
Because
over-promising is certainly not going to work.
Yeah.
It's also, and not to go too far down this path, but it's also an argument for treatment without ancillary services for many populations is not going to do the trick. If employment opportunities aren't there, if educational opportunities aren't there, food insecurity is an issue, if childcare isn't there, you know, you can functional analysis the heck out of a situation, and it might not get people anywhere.
That, I think that's a great point. I mean, we're fighting not a losing battle, but a more difficult battle, I guess, if you don't have access to all those services. But the other thing I'm hearing you saying is that a lot of these changes that might occur are long-term in nature. They're long-term, they're delayed rewards, you know? And so structuring the therapy to somehow provide short-term bursts of reward that reinforce that behavior while it's building. Sounds like that's probably a good idea as well.
I'll steal a phrase from a mentor of mine, Roger Weiss, here at McLean, who's wonderful. And he always talks about when people come into treatment, oftentimes fear is a motivator. Fear of what? Fear of loss of relationships or job or life in some cases. And he says, fear is never enough. You need fear and hope. Mm. And sometimes I think that's sort of our job is, okay, the fear is already there. Where do we build the hope? And that can be in the sort of, like you said, sort of day-to-day rewards. How can we get some movement forward, some reward, some hope in the day-to-day? But I think it is also about the longer-term hope. You know, what would life look like after this change?
Yeah.
Again, whether it's full removal of substances or more of a harm reduction approach.
Right.
What does this look like next? Building that hope, I think, is an essential piece.
And thank you for mentioning that, like that this can be sort of done in a way that, you know, has an abstinence goal or a harm reduction goal. And actually, in general, I think it'd be really nice to hear. So like, how long does CBT take? So in fact, what I wonder if you have sort of a vignette of a client, just something that you could make up, and maybe you could walk us through your therapy with them, you know, over a couple of minutes, just saying what you might do, what kind of modules you might sort of discuss, and what you would expect to come up, like barriers that might come up.
Sure. So I can give you, you know, a common sort of prototypical situation that we might come up with is someone is coming out of a detox or residential level of care, who, you know, let's pick opioid use disorder. You know, they are stable. They're sort of off the opioids. Their withdrawal is for the most part behind them. You know, we will really typically start with this functional analysis because in part, this also allows us to personalize the treatment to the individual. And I think this is actually a misconception about CBT because it's a manualized treatment. It typically, you know, 12 to 20 sessions is what you typically see. That's typically what's studied. In part, that's an artifact of what insurance used to and to some extent still reimburses for, as opposed to what we actually think is meaningful. But 12 to 20 sessions is what we typically target. The way I'll often frame it to people as a CBT therapist is my goal is to make myself useless.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I literally say that exact same thing.
I've said that. Yeah. Like yeah. It, with every
my job
client.
Is to make you become your own therapist. No. I'm the only person who's trying to put myself out of business.
Yeah.
I'm glad I'm not the only one who makes that argument. Like a terrible businesswoman. Yeah. I'm trying to put myself out of business.
Yeah. We would have failed business school. All of
yeah,
us.
Yeah. Glad I didn't go into that.
Academia. Good choice. Yes. Everybody.
Right.
Exactly.
So that's typically, you know, the goal is I am going to transfer these skills to this person so they can continue to use them. And in terms of the efficacy data, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit later, I think that's in part why you see more durability with CBT effects than you do for many other types of interventions. So typically we'll start with a functional analysis. I can tell you something that I will often see very early in treatment is a tremendous amount of anhedonia.
Yep.
Difficulty. So you imagine you're hammering away at this reward system of the brain with something like an opioid, and now you want to go have ice cream with your kids or go to the baseball game and you feel nothing. And not only do you feel nothing, and then you feel guilty about feeling nothing.
Yeah, because it's your kids.
Your kids, right. I should. How am I not?
Society tells me I should feel good at this. My past experience tells me I should feel good in this moment, and I feel nothingness.
Yeah. And what does that mean about me is the next step.
Yeah, there it goes. Right. Then that's the spiral happens.
Yeah. I'll never get better. I'm a bad guy, or, you know, all those things sort of start from there. Yeah. So oftentimes, you know, if that's one of the things that we see, we'll really look to build in natural rewards, might do a little bit of behavioral activation there, which is just hammer away at natural rewards, get as many in the system as we can. And I'll oftentimes give people the expectation that your goal in the short term is not to feel good. Your goal in the short term is to show up. And the more you show up, the more the reward system will start to reset. So oftentimes that's someplace where we'll start getting rid of triggers that can be removed is oftentimes another very early in treatment one. So this is deleting the phone numbers and blocking the phone numbers that you really shouldn't have anymore.
Yeah.
And again,
dealers or friends. Yeah.
And blocking and deleting. I feel like that combo is really important. So the block then delete. So doing that, doing sort of the inventory of are there any substances in the house? You know, do you have 6 Percocet in your winter coat in the summer? So oftentimes it's are there any triggers that we can get rid of? Can we remove any of that?
Yeah.
Then it will shift to more skills-based work. So oftentimes some of the big skills that will hit refusal skills are one, which is how do you turn down the offer for a substance?
Yeah.
That's a really important one in part because it's sort of a combo of a social skill and sort of a substance use skill. That's one where we'll do a lot of role play in terms of how do you say no? What are you going to say? How are you going to do it? I think one really important piece of CBT is it's like learning to play the violin or learning how to shoot a free throw. I can tell you how to do it all day long, and it's not going to make you any better at doing it. You need to actually rehearse it yourself. So
I like those. I like those examples a lot too, because even a professional misses a free throw every once in a while. It sort of also gives the individual the permission to have a chance where they mess up.
It takes time. Mm-hmm. You don't get good at it after a day.
Yeah.
Or after talking about it for 5 minutes.
Right.
So I think that that's a really essential piece. One of the things that can be challenging is that's harder to do. You know, it's uncomfortable and, you know, you have to build a comfort level with doing it. It's easier to just talk about things. So some of that does involve expectation setting with people. Because oftentimes I think people's image of therapy is I come and I lay on your couch and we talk for an hour, which is not what CBT is. The other big skill that we'll often hit is coping skills are another big one. You know, oftentimes, particularly by the time someone is at a substance use disorder level, substances are playing both a reward and a relief function.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, I was thinking about it when you were talking about getting rid of triggers. Is like I imagine it's very common for clients to be hesitant to get rid of it's almost like an escape plan, you know, like, well, what if I can't handle it? I need to, in some really tough event, I need to be able to reach out and get, you know, get the opioid that I know is going to bring me that relief. How do you address that?
I feel like I'm cheating. It's so funny that you bring up this example. I was coding tapes from a clinical trial yesterday, and this exact issue came up.
Wow.
Of the, you know, I have my emergency. It's like 6 or 8 Percocet, just in case.
Yeah.
And this came up. It was actually interesting that the person, the client in the situation actually even reflected that. He said, you know, this is, why am I holding on to this as my just in case? You know, and to some extent it's a, you know, and this is not necessarily a CBT strategy, one that's often used in the strategy, is sort of playing the tape forward, sort of walking through like, okay, so you want to have this there. What would happen next? What would happen if you did use that? Where would you go next? What would happen the day after?
Right.
And sort of walking through that process of what would be the consequences, not just in the moment, but in 15 minutes, in an hour, in a day, in a week. That's oftentimes a strategy that we'll use in that situation, because it is amazing when you actually get, when rubber meets the road and you say, okay, I want you to get rid of those 6 Percocet, or I want you to block and delete this number. People say yes, 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 until you get to the point where you actually ask them to do it. And then oftentimes they'll get a, wait.
No, yeah. It's scary.
You want me to do it now?
Yeah. I mean, it's the thing, you know, I think a lot of people rely on these things and, you know, someone who has lost a lot of social connection in their lives, maybe lost a job, maybe lost opportunities, don't have much going on. That might be the only consistent thing in their life that brings them any amount of joy. And then you're asking them to put that aside. And then there's a chance that there's nothing that brings them any pleasure.
Yeah.
I think that's a really scary thing to do.
Yeah, especially when they're feeling anhedonia.
Yeah.
Right. Cause then it seems like that they don't know how long that lasts. Right. Like, and it varies depending on, you know, the disorder and things like that. But I think generally the data bears out between 30 and 90 days that takes for your body to reach homeostasis again in the reward system. But that seems like an eternity, right? When you go have ice cream with your kids for the first time, maybe in a while, and you're feeling nothing. And then I'm saying, I also want you to get rid of your break glass in case of emergency, or like contacts that are like, not just, you know, just like random so-and-so who I can get some pills from, but like maybe somebody who's like really meaningful, but also kind of dangerous for me to be around, like a lifelong friend, you know, that like, I just can't be around them right now because it's dangerous for me, you know, given this, I have these goals to make behavior change. And now you're saying maybe I should like remove these people from my contact, right? Like that's a very challenging space to be in.
That's one where I think is you get into values work as well, because there ends up eventually getting, you end up eventually in a gray area where, you know, you think of this like with little kids. You can keep a kid safe if you wrap them in bubble wrap and put a helmet on them and lock them in their room all the time. And then you lock the windows and they'll never be exposed to an allergen, and, you know, they'll never get hurt. They'll never scrape a knee, but wouldn't be a great quality of life.
Yeah.
And I think those gray areas around, what do you want that, whether it's a social circle, whether it's a functional circle, what do you want that to look like? And what, you know, how much of that is a values decision? How much of that is more of the sort of keep the door open to return to substance use decision? Those get really tricky.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's an excellent point, right? Especially when you're talking about like these lifelong friends versus like some random connect that's, you know, only providing you with, you know, drugs or something like this, right? But ultimately the idea here is that these people, that individuals, anybody who's making a behavior change, right, but people with substance use disorder specifically, are going to be able to navigate their world and not have to like worry about whether or not they're going to come into contact with so-and-so at the grocery store, right? Like that they could deal with that, and that's where the rehearsal and the skill building and even just like shuffling through the values work of like when these things come up in opposition with each other, like lifelong friend, haven't seen it forever, really want to know how they're going, also trying to make a behavior change around my drug use, and those things might not be compatible in this moment, how am I going to make a decision around that, right? And that's why I think that values clarification can be so just genuinely helpful for them to help make decisions.
Kate, how much in your work do you use mindfulness, incorporate those types of practices?
I do a fair bit, oftentimes as part of an alternative. Sometimes we will do this for more of a coping reason. I will also sometimes fold that into a cognitive intervention, especially if I have, if I'm working with someone where there's a lot of rumination and worry. Which is not uncommon in this population, is I'm replaying the tape of every bad thing I've ever done, and I'm worried about every future thing, is if we can just anchor people in the moment a little bit more. So I incorporate that a fair bit. I think it fits very cleanly into CBT.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think of it, it's just a kind of CBT.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I think about it, right? Like mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, right? Like is about interrupting the ruminative thought process in part by, you know, your time traveling in your mind, right?
Yeah.
So what's the directly incompatible with that being in the present moment?
Yeah.
Well, right? So bringing them.
Yeah. And I mean, third wave therapies like ACT, this came up in my mind, Noah, because you talked about when you're in a moment and you see this friend and they invite you, and then there's this values conflict. A lot of times, maybe you have this intuition that something's wrong, or that you have a conflict, but it can be very hard for I think as humans to stop in the moment and actually recognize what that conflict is. And so I think that mindfulness can also be a useful tool just for helping people become aware of the thoughts that they're having when in a moment, when their values need to be accessed, and you know, how to make that decision, I guess, about which value to pick.
Awareness is so important, even in terms of thinking about when do you need to be more vigilant? This is where self-monitoring is a really important part of CBT, is monitoring, you know, whatever the pertinent subjective state is. Is it craving? Is it irritability? Is it mood? Is, you know, you've had a couple of bad nights of sleep and you're overtired and you're irritable, you know, recognizing that allows you to say, okay, today is the day that I have to be really cautious. Today's the day I need to make sure I don't answer that phone call if I get one that can be risky. Right. Today's the day maybe I shouldn't go out to dinner and be in a place where I could be exposed to alcohol. So having that awareness of, okay, I actually have to have my guard up a little bit more today, I think can be really important early in recovery.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, knowing those risky situations, right? Or I like to, a lot of time refer to them as like pressure points for a person in their day. Like you're only at risk for maybe like 20 minutes of the day, right? And so like knowing when those 20 minutes are, what's going on in those 20 minutes is incredibly meaningful. And that's where, you know, taking the skills outside of the session really, right? So role-playing in the session, I think has a lot to be, can be really helpful, you know, just teaching them a little bit about what's going to go on there as they evaluate what's going on inside their mind and so forth. And then teaching them to be able to pay attention in the moment. And then they go out there and they have to implement it. Right. And then coming back, right. Oh, you missed some free throws. Right. Like what happened? All right. And just kind of running through it again, I think is so crucial.
We haven't talked about, you know, we'll use the H word is homework, which is a big piece of this. And
great point.
If you're going to indulge my basketball metaphors, and I'm going to stick with them, but you think about shooting a free throw, right? You learn how to shoot a free throw in an empty driveway or in an empty gym. That's where you start.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then you start to do it in front of a small crowd or in front of a team. And then you start to do it in front of a larger crowd, and you sort of work your way. And at each stage, it gets a little bit harder and you're sort of building on that rehearsal from the previous experience. And that's where I think both the role play and the rehearsal is really important, is you're doing the role play in the session, and then I'm having you hopefully engage in that outside of the session, change context, change difficulty level. That I think is a really important piece. So that people are rehearsing these skills in different contexts, different difficulty levels, because it's not as simple as, you know, okay, you can sit here and do this with me. What are you going to do when you're out someplace where you could actually have access to something?
Yeah. I think that's a really good, and just understanding developmentally, but I guess, you know, in the progression of treatment, like where you are, you couldn't expect maybe as someone who is just coming into treatment to go out and be able to face, you know, going to a party with all of your friends where everyone's using, you know, that might be a situation that you fail at. And giving yourself grace and empathy for having done that, because, you know, you are still at the shooting alone in the driveway phase. Yeah, I like that point a lot. And I love the metaphor. So
agreed.
Thanks for indulging.
Agreed. No, I think that makes total sense. And so it sounds like, you know, as we're walking through this kind of, you know, vignette kind of prototypical, right? So you kind of start off with some functional analysis, and then we start doing some skill building, and then sounds like you start doing some rehearsal. When does that start coming online for you, kind of like in the course of treatment, would you say?
Early. Mm-hmm. I start early. Unless there's a good reason not to.
Good point.
Which I'm not entirely sure what I would consider a good reason not to is, you know,
it's just resistance.
Right. Well, maybe
there's certain situations where I might say maybe not that kind, but let's do this other one.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I don't want you to rehearse like out there. Let's do it in here. You know. Right. Like,
right. Don't walk into a bar and practice your refusal skills.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Not on the first go.
Right. Off you go.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that starts building, sounds like.
I think doing it as early as possible is important, in part because people are living their lives. They're not delaying it. It's,
agreed. That's the beauty of outpatient treatment. If I could quickly just make a plug for outpatient treatment, right? Like, that's the beauty of it, right? Like, you're coming, you're hanging out with us, whether it's partial hospital, which is, you know, all day, 5 days a week, but you go home at night and we can try those things on. And you come back the very next day and be like, my mom, not ready for that. Dad, I'm cool. Mom, I'm not. So like, we need to run through some stuff about how I'm going to deal with my mom or whatever it is.
And that gives you, I think there's also, you want to leverage what's coming into the room. So this is where I think rehearsal can come on board really early. It doesn't have to be all artificial. Is someone comes in and they're frustrated or they're anxious, leverage that. Let's practice a skill right now and see if that takes a little bit of the edge off that frustration or that anxiety. Because I think, you know, when people come into treatment, self-efficacy tends to be low. You know, I don't know if this is going to work. I don't know if I can do this. That's something we always have to fend against. So if we can build a change early, even if it's a little one, you know, low-hanging fruit to get a quick win, you know, to some extent, the goal of your first two sessions is to get the person to come back for the third.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. So what do you start doing in the CBT context as you get to the later stages of treatment in those, you know, we're double digit sessions. What starts happening in those phases?
So that's, I think, where you get more into skill generalization, is how do you apply it to different contexts? How do you apply it to different high risk situations? And if you almost think of, you sort of have these two processes that are going on, you know, early in treatment, there's probably a little bit more avoidance. So staying away from more high risk situations, trying to be really cautious in that very vulnerable early phase. And as time goes on, you start to shift towards more building resilience. You know, you're doing both at the same time, but they sort of, at some point they sort of cross where, you know, we're not necessarily focused as much on how do we wrap you in bubble wrap now, but more on what are you going to do to use your grocery store example? What are you going to do when you run into somebody in the grocery store? You know, how are you going to navigate these new situations? So I think that's when the skill generalization, how do we put this in higher risk situations, starts to build. It's also where I think you start to get into relapse prevention mode, particularly once you get into those double digit sessions. What are your red flags? What are your orange flags? This is another place where mindfulness, I think, really comes in, is how do you build that awareness of catching the very earliest possible indicator, not the latest possible indicator when you're, you know, halfway to the bar. Earlier you can catch it, the more options you have. So that tends to shift as, like I said, as we get to the double digits, that's oftentimes where we'll really start to shift to.
Yeah. I think those warning signs, right, are like so crucial to start to develop an awareness of, right? I often like to use the metaphor of like trying to turn a ship. Like, it's going to take a long time to get us. So like, we need to really know ahead of time where we want to go. And, you know, picking up on things like, oh, I'm starting to be, you know, maybe isolate more, right? Like, these are the kinds of things that we're talking about versus like, oh, spontaneously I'm in a high risk situation, which is craving a lot, friend at the grocery store, right? Got to go to the wedding, right? Like, you know, whatever it might be, versus like, I'm starting to isolate more, you know, maybe I'm starting to change behaviors that came on board during the skill building phase that are now starting to slide back, that are more consistent with how I was at a previous stage, you know, before I, you know, embarked on this behavior change, right? Just kind of like knowing those kinds of things are so crucial, and being able to pay attention and know yourself, right?
Kate, do you ever have clients that they set a goal, and maybe it's an abstinence goal or maybe a near abstinence goal, and then they get far into it, they've been doing a pretty good job, and their tune sort of shifts. They like want to maybe start using every so often, whatever it is, drinking or whatever, that with a friend, or I think that seems like a really tough situation, and it, because in some cases, you know, you want to follow the lead of the client and be respectful of how they want to approach their lives, as long as it's not going to sort of derail everything. On the other hand, there's that, at least for me internally, there's that fear that, well, is this just like craving and then justification for, you know, wanting. So how would you deal with that?
One of the things I like about a CBT frame compared to some of the older therapeutic frames is I can be really upfront with people, and I'm my tone as a therapist tends to be very transparent. So if I'm having that thought, I'm going to share it. And I think pointing that out to people can be important. So if you start to see that shift, and I agree with you that shift can mean a lot of different things. It can mean we're actually sort of trickling towards a relapse process. It could mean someone's goal has shifted,
right,
and they would like to move to a different kind of plan. It depends a little bit on the substance too. I mean, that's certainly, you know, it's a different conversation if we're talking about opioids versus alcohol.
Right. Yeah.
So typically I'll be very transparent with people. If I have a concern, I think we do a lot of sort of forward, okay, what would this look like if you were to do this? What are the downsides of doing it? What are the pros and cons of doing this?
Yeah.
One downside I'll often talk to people about is, I should find the study that I cite. I cite this vaguely. There's a chocolate cake study. I've probably confabulated this over time, so you feel free to call me out on this. I've created in my head this chocolate cake study.
It was a dream.
It was a dream, yes. Yeah. I was dreaming about fMRI dieting research, but they had two groups, and one group was told, you know, your dieting strategy will mean no more chocolate cake. It's off your list. And the other group was told, you know what? You can have chocolate cake sometimes. And they did a bunch of cognitive tasks and looked at, and the people who, for whom the chocolate cake was still an option, actually were having to work harder cognitively, because you're always having to do that sense of, can I have it now? Is today a chocolate cake day?
Yeah.
And so I'll often use that, again, whether I've confabulated that study or not, I'll often use that metaphor with people to say, if when it's now on the table, there's an element of it that's actually harder, because you're having to sort of process this, is today an okay day? Is this the okay level? Am I doing this right? Am I doing that right? So I think that's a downside that I will disclose to people. It doesn't mean no, it doesn't mean don't go down that path, but it's another thing to think about. And if people do want to go the harm reduction route, I think the key is really clear goals, very, very clear markers on, okay, what is the goal and what is the sign that things start to go badly?
Yeah.
That we're sort of trickling into a bad place. But yeah, I think transparency is what I go with in those situations.
Yeah.
No, yeah. I think that makes total sense. Yeah. And we had an episode with Katie Wickowitz, and she talked about, you know, the idea that, you know, there's just so many more decision points with non-abstinence goals, right? Like, it's just like, you know, under what conditions is it too much, or, you know, and where am I kind of threading the needle?
Yeah.
And what's okay. And, you know, being really upfront with people to establish those benchmarks and making sure they come back to therapy, even though they've been drinking, right? Like, that's not like, that doesn't destroy our relationship. I'm here to support you. Right. But come back in so we can check in, you know, so that we can help, you know, make sure that there's these kind of firm boundaries around, like, when it's chocolate cake day and when it's not. Right. And that's a very sophisticated and you know, challenging approach. And so I think, you know, being really upfront with people, that's one of the beautiful things I think about CBT, is just keeping it, you know, totally authentic with people and just being like, you know, here are my concerns and, you know, I'm here to support you in whatever way makes sense. And so I really appreciate that perspective.
Yeah, it's such a great point that, of course, Katie made a great point. She's brilliant. Go figure. Katie Wickowitz made a great point.
Yeah.
It was a first time for everything.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, even a broken clock is right twice a day, right?
But it's the harder path in many ways. You know, it's...
Yeah. And I can see, and for some people, that it seems like the easier path.
Yeah.
Right. It requires the least amount of change, but the most amount of decisions. Right. And so it's just about understanding the kind of the balance between these things and evaluating those things. And I think it's important to, as you've already alluded to, right? Like, you just have that conversation with people at the very beginning, like, what does it look like for you? What do you want your life to look like? How does that come to life? Here are the things that, here are what the evidence shows us, like on that kind of goal, you know, does that make sense? You know, and things like that, and understanding, you know, what are the predictors of these types of goal changes and who do they make sense for and things like that, or research that still needs to be done in part. And I know that you're doing a bunch of work that's kind of seeking to improve CBT in meaningful ways. And I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about that.
Sure. So where we're at with CBT, It's an efficacious and effective treatment, meaning it does well in controlled settings, it does well in uncontrolled settings, it does well when you add it to medication. It's a very robust treatment, it works. But there are two places that I think we need to go next. One is, we have a good treatment and very few people have access to it. That's sort of issue one. And I can't believe we've been talking and we haven't mentioned I haven't mentioned Kathy Carroll yet, who... Oh my goodness, has she been just the luminary in the field on this, and just a tragic loss.
Yeah.
Certainly for her family and the community there and the broader addiction community.
Yeah. Truly a titan in the field.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
And one of the nicest people you would ever meet. You know, you would share a subway ride with her, and you would remember that 15 minutes for the next 10 years because she was just that kind of person. So you know, she is someone, and I think one of her many, many, many legacies will be the work that she has really started and moved forward. And I think the groups at Yale are continuing to move forward on web-based CBT for CBT, her computerized treatment, which has tremendous effects. And I think real promise for getting more people access to this treatment. So I think there's great work, really important work happening on that end. I think my research has been a little bit more focused on how do we actually improve efficacy? How do we make this better? And the two places where we've been thinking about this, one is from a personalized medicine perspective, is how do we understand meaningful units of heterogeneity? Because these are remarkably heterogeneous disorders in terms of co-occurring disorders and how the disorders present. What is actually a meaningful unit of heterogeneity that might determine what treatment somebody needs? Whether even maybe that's between CBT and another treatment, or maybe within CBT, what types of treatments people need? So that's sort of one area. We've been mostly interested in sort of stress and relief related processes. Because relief is a tough one to target. The other piece that we've been looking at is, so when you test a CBT protocol, you're talking about, again, 12 to 20 sessions with lots of bits and pieces in it. And you give it to people over a couple of months and you see how well they do. And it's very hard to know what is the thing that's actually making a difference. What's the active ingredient? What's the less active ingredient? So we're doing a fair bit of sort of clinical analog studies. If we can train this strategy right now and we make sure that people are actually using it, does it do the thing we think it will? You know, if we implement this strategy, will it decrease stress reactivity? And will it do it in everybody? Will it actually only do it in a subgroup of people? So that's a lot of what we've been focused on. Can we actually enhance the precision of some of these behavioral interventions?
Yeah, precision medicine or personalized medicine, I guess, are the words that are coming to my mind. And in part, this is a problem with the definition of substance use disorder. And, you know, everyone kind of disagrees on what addiction is. Yeah. But then also this, you know, clinical set of symptoms where you have to have two of them to be, you know, considered to have a mild substance use disorder. And it could be any of the 11. That makes it really hard, really, to come up with something that is uniform that would address all cases of substance use disorder.
Right. Even within, you know, pick a specific substance use disorder and pick a specific even if we said, okay, we're only going to talk about people with opioid use disorder and co-occurring PTSD, you'd still have tremendous heterogeneity
in there,
in terms of course, in terms of history, in terms of, you know, what skills people actually come in already in pretty good shape with and what skills they actually might need more support on. And again, we think about what are actually the meaningful units. So oftentimes we think of diagnosis.
Right.
Do they also have PTSD? Do they also have bipolar disorder? And that is a meaningful unit, but there's also a lot of heterogeneity in there. Mm-hmm. So actually, are there other units that we can actually be thinking about, whatever that might be, whether it's motives for use, whether it's some neurocognitive process, what's actually meaningful as we think about personalized?
Right.
Yeah. I think that's because I think this is an important distinction, right? Like meaningful units of heterogeneity versus heterogeneity. Because though I think what we're talking about is a data reduction approach here, right? Because like the heterogeneity is just like, there's like, I think 170,000 combination of 11 symptoms to meet two in a year, which is what you need for mild, right? And it's just like, at what point are those like meaningful or not, right? So the idea that we could reduce it to like, okay, this difference, right? This combination is meaningful, meaningfully different than this combination. And that charts for us a course in therapy that would be have a meaningful, you know, like therapeutic approach or target related differences, right? And then even just the active ingredients within a specific treatment like CBT, for instance, has many active ingredient components, right, that are potentially conferring benefit, right? And like, which one of those map onto then this, you know, meaningful unit of heterogeneity, right? Like what you're talking about is very complicated. And so like, thank you Because like it's really essential for us to be able to figure this stuff out. And we've had people on talk about, you know, like differences in endophenotype and things like that. Like we had Tori Vota on.
Yeah, and actually I'm thinking that you guys actually do some work together. Is that true?
Yeah, so I would like to declare myself publicly the president of the Tori Vota fan club. can I get?
Yeah.
Establish a place for that. You're the president.
So yeah, yes, president, I've declared president myself president.
Founder.
Nominee.
What's your first move as the president of the
club?
Well,
I just announced it. The announcement
is
number one. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Obviously.
I'll give you my 10-point plan from here. Tori's awesome. She worked here at McLean for a couple of years before she went up to UNM. Mm-hmm. And we've managed to keep a hold of her in part to do some work. She's doing tremendous work. She's going to move the field in some great directions.
Oh, so, absolutely. Yeah.
Agreed.
It's awesome.
Agreed. Yeah, I think that work is the work that you're doing and the work others are doing in that similar space, I think are just so needed. And finally, we're kind of like out of a place computationally where we can begin to start to look at some of these kinds of things. You know, there are machine learning approaches and other things like that. And one of my favorite papers to talk about with CBT machine learning was one where they coded a bunch of tapes. I think it was like 20,000 hours of tapes, the utterances, like you're talking about, and then looked at what those utterances predicted, the frequency of specific types of phrases used, predicting change. And they found, it's a JAMA article where they found, I think it's Michael Eubank, sorry if that's not the author or how you pronounce it, but they found that the number one effect size in CBT was therapeutic praise. And the biggest effect size was just not what you think about when we go into the manual and we're like, what are the active ingredients of CBT? It's like thought records, right? Or behavior activation or whatever it may be. And those had effects too. They were like number two and three, but therapeutic praise, right? So it's like the installation of hope and all these different types of things that go along with it, which you've talked about, you know, kind of throughout here. I think we can really discover like things to lean into that are happening in the kind of under the hood parts of our therapies and map those meaningfully onto specific presentations for people so that we know for whom, under what conditions, this is going to be the best approach, right? Like for you, right? Like maybe, you know, AA would make a lot of sense and we'll do some other stuff and abstinence is what we need, right? And there's other people like, do not go to AA. That's a terrible idea for you. And we need this, you know, harm reduction goal and the CBT approach here that will really be, you know, important, you know, to help produce kind of equity across the spectrum of heterogeneity for outcome, right? Like in the efficacy of treatments, if that makes sense.
It makes me think of a finding that I love, and this has not been brought over the substance use disorders that I can think of. I think it's more in the depression anxiety literature, but the relationship between treatment fidelity and outcome.
Mm.
So there's been a lot of talk about, you know, treatment fidelity and outcome are not related. Doesn't matter what you do, you know, the sort of dodo bird effect perspective. That is true if you look at it linearly. But what you actually, if you look at a nonlinear model, the strongest treatment outcomes are at a moderate degree of manual fidelity. And what I think that really means is when we have some level of flexibility to the individual, like as you're talking about what the individual actually needs and prefers, we don't talk nearly enough about what people prefer to do.
Yeah.
What do people prefer? What do they need? Where are they coming in? If we can actually sort of keep fidelity to some of these pieces, but also meet the individual needs, and again, some of that heterogeneity, I think that's what we're really going to help people optimize outcomes.
Well, and then that question alone, just about the relationship between fidelity and you know, treatment effect is a product of the zeitgeist in which manualized treatments came about, you know. And I think that it's the work that you're doing, that Tori's doing, that a lot of people are doing, it suggests sort of a fundamental shift almost towards process-based approaches where mm-hmm. you're looking at these different levels of units. I mean, using some of the language that you discussed, and you know, we might find a shift away from even that sort of way of thinking into this new sort of way of approaching. Because at one point, manualized treatment and following it to a T was kind of the hope and expectation of all psychologists. And over time that has just diminished. And I think even since I've been in the field for, you know, like the last 6 years or so, I've noticed even that people are moving, I wouldn't say away from manualized treatments, but they just understand the limitations in practice. So I just suspect that that's the direction that it's going to go in. And I think you all are sort of on the front line.
There's a term that I love from the implementation science literature. I think this is the CIFR model. They talk about the adaptable periphery, that there's sort of the core elements of a treatment, then there's the adaptable periphery. And I think, you know, when we can operate in the adaptable periphery, mm-hmm. I think that's, you know, we can sort of maintain that, what is the active ingredient while also doing some of that adjustment.
Yeah.
So I think the thing that we have to be cautious about, I think there's so much potential in sort of more of a process-based, you know, I have 12 tools and I can mm-hmm. sort of pull, you know, okay, I need a hammer this time. I need mm-hmm. a, you know, Phillips head screwdriver this time. The only thing that we have to guard against, I think, as a clinician for that is, okay, it's hour 10 of my day and I'm really tired and I have these 12 tools that I can pull up. And this one's actually the easiest one.
Yeah.
You know, so I think yeah. there's some element of, you know, how do we sort of find that sweet spot between having enough structure that we can maintain sure. the evidence base, but also work around this, you know, adaptive periphery.
Yeah. Kate, this has been really awesome. And we'd like to transition at this point to sort of our take home messages. What do you think the take home message is for people who are in recovery, who might, you know, be coming to get CBT?
I think the general take home is what treatment you get matters, and not all treatment is the same, particularly on the therapy end. It's so important for us to educate consumers better about what options are, and mm-hmm. and not all therapy options are the same. Not all are equally effective. CBT is a great one. It's an effective one. There are other effective treatments out there. So I think for people in recovery, asking what you're getting, you know, expecting informed consent, what is the treatment I'm getting? What are some alternatives? I think that's really important as people are thinking about, is CBT something that's for me? This is one, you know, this is like going to the gym. You'll the more you put in, the more you'll get out.
Yeah.
That's a great fit for some people. It's a less great fit for others.
Agreed. What would you say to practitioners that are listening? What do you think the take-home message is?
The thing that I would want practitioners to understand more than anything is CBT is not an overly rigid, takes the decisions out of your hands treatment. I think that is probably the number one misconception. It's something I hear from people a lot is, mm-hmm. if you are rigidly following a manual, you're doing it wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a tremendous amount of flexibility where you can really leverage therapeutic style and therapeutic skills, but it gives you that evidence base. It gives you something to sort of hold on to as you're doing treatment.
Yeah, absolutely. What would you say the take-home message is for policymakers?
Oh my goodness, please reimburse this stuff better. Can I say that? Is that fair?
Yes.
That is, yeah.
Yeah, I'd say that's more than fair.
Okay. Improve access and reimburse this at the right rate so we can get more of it out there.
Yeah.
You under reimburse something, you are going to have workforce gaps. You just will.
Yeah. Beyond substance use, I'm shocked at how many things CBT is the frontline treatment for, or just talk therapies in general. Or it was at one point. I know, like in the 80s, I think talk therapy was a huge part of pain management. And, you know, that obviously shifted towards opioids in the 90s. But yeah,
I come back.
It is. And I think that, yeah, I think it's important for policymakers to know that. So thanks for making that point.
Yeah, seriously.
I did the very first, it was my master's thesis actually in graduate school. Did a cost efficacy analysis. This was for panic disorder, of therapy versus meds for panic disorder. And at the time you're talking about generic, cheap medications, cost efficacy is higher for CBT because the effects are more durable.
Yeah.
Your costs are all on the front end, and you get that continued benefit. And I think there are so many conditions. Insomnia is another great one. Insomnia, CBT for insomnia is great. You don't have to stay on medication forever. Yep. It works. I think the policy, and particularly the payment structures, have to catch up to that.
Yeah.
What would you say take-home messages for underserved populations?
I give a similar message to the your first question about people in recovery, which is these treatments do work. It matters what you get. And I think one of the issues for underserved populations, and we're talking about CBT, the underserved population is actually very broad, tremendously broad, is ask for the services. Ask what you're getting. Ask for what your options are. I think really empowering consumers is going to be important. You know, is a consumer in a tough position to change a system? Yes, but as a collective, if people know what to ask for, I think that's really important. The other point I would make again is these are much more flexible treatments than I think people anticipate. Adaptations to different populations, to different cultural backgrounds, have been tremendously successful within CBT. Again, we really do have a lot of that adaptable periphery with this treatment. So they do appear to be tremendously broadly applicable.
Yeah.
Well, this has been great, Kate. One final question for you. You've been really successful throughout your career, had a great career so far of really merging research and clinical work. And do you have any advice for trainees out there?
Well, my first piece of advice is don't take overly simplistic advice.
That's the first.
That's a paradox. I mean,
ignore everything I'm about to say. Yes. And I say it because everybody is different. We talked about this with Stu. Yeah. Everybody is different, and you can get a lot of really toxic messages. And I still hear these things like, if you want to be a successful academic, you have to be willing to sleep 4 hours a night. If you want to be a successful academic, you have to be willing to write at 3 o'clock in the morning. I just don't buy it, you know, and maybe for some people that is the model that they need. So I would say just beware that overly simplistic advice, especially if it sounds torturous. Be a little bit careful.
Yeah.
I would say the big things for me is find a good team. And by team, I mean mentors, I mean collaborators, I mean mentees, you know, find the people that you love to work with. Because I think that makes a huge difference for both productivity and happiness at work. You're happy at work, you're going to be more productive.
Mm-hmm.
And the one other thing I'll mention is buy efficiency. That's how I always think about my productivity, is where can I actually get more efficient, not where mm-hmm. can I work more. If I can be more efficient, if I get 8 hours of sleep, and I could do in 10 hours what I would do in 12 if I was sleep deprived.
Yeah.
That's a win. So really thinking about what are the ways that you can buy efficiency, and one of the best ways to buy efficiency is to take care of some of the basics outside of work.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great advice. Thanks, Kate.
Agreed.
After I told you not to take any advice. So.
Yeah, I'm going to have to think on that. I don't know, you know, I don't know whether to believe you or not, but yeah, no, that's great. And yeah, I think that there are a lot of different people out there with a lot of different needs, and you know, I guess finding which piece of advice work best for you. And I love the efficiency recommendation, because I mean, I guess that's the whole work smarter, not harder, you know, mantra. But yeah, I think it just gives you more time to be yourself outside of work. If you can, I think some people then fit more work into that extra time. So I guess that, you know, if that's what you want to do too, but, yeah, well, thank you so much, Kate. This was awesome. Really informative. And I just really appreciate your time.
Agreed. Thanks so much to you both. This was a blast. This was a lot of fun. And again, really enjoy and appreciate what you all are doing to disseminate this information, and we'll continue to be a happy listener.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
Next time on the
addiction psychologist, we will have Dr. Stephen Higgins join us. Stephen is a professor of psychology, professor of psychiatry, and director of the Vermont Center on Behavior and Health at the University of Vermont. He's going to be talking to us about contingency management in the next in our series on interventions for substance use disorder.